The subject of today's talk is Religious Faith Irrational. Perhaps a couple of words about myself. I'm a lecturer here at Southampton in the philosophy department. I've written a book on Wittgenstein's and Kierkegaard's conceptions of religious belief. But what I'm going to do today is just to give you a bit of a sense of how one might argue either for the thesis that religious belief is irrational or against that. So I'm just going to, as it were, sketch the lay of the land out for you and then open the whole thing up to discussion. So I'll be talking for about 30 minutes-ish, I think. Okay, so first of all, of course, when tackling a question like this, one has to try and get a bit clearer about what the terms that the question contains actually mean. So what is it, for example, to speak of religious faith in the first place? I mean, obviously, that in itself is quite a huge philosophical question and not one I can hope to answer today. So for the purposes of this talk, I'm just going to take religious faith to mean, intuitively, belief in the existence of God. Now, that in itself might be contentious. There are all sorts of different takes on even this question, but for the sake of this talk, I'm just going to assume that religious faith means belief in the existence of God. Now, the second crucial term is, of course, rationality and irrationality. What is it for a belief to be rational or for a belief to be irrational? Well, again, one might say roughly a rational belief is a belief based on the best available evidence. Now, again, one might think perhaps that's a rather strong contention. Why? Well, because obviously we believe all sorts of things on hearsay, say, or because we have learnt certain things at school, or because we have read things, or because we've picked them up from what our friends have said, or from watching programmes on TV, and so on. So if every belief would really have to be justified on the basis of the best available evidence, we'd probably have to spend a lot of time trying to make sure whether the things that we actually believe are really held on the basis of the best available evidence. So obviously this is only a kind of rough and ready way of trying to tackle the issue, because we might have to say that a lot of beliefs can be rational even if they're not based on the absolutely best available evidence out there. So that's perhaps a slightly too strong starting point. Nevertheless, it might still help us to get a sense of what it might mean to say that a belief is irrational, because for this one might think the criteria are slightly more relaxed, in the sense that it seems sufficient to say that a belief is irrational if it's based on, say, extremely flimsy evidence, or indeed if there is no proper relation at all between the belief and the evidence available. So a very crass example of that might be, for example, someone who dreams that Manchester United wins the Champions League and on the basis of that believes, or comes to believe, that Manchester United will win the Champions League. And it doesn't really matter whether, in actual fact, Manchester United wins the Champions League or not. Obviously, there is no causal connection whatsoever between the fact that I've dreamt something and this thing coming to pass. So, you know, if one were to argue, I believe this because I've had this dream, then clearly there is no relevant connection at all between the belief and the evidence that I'm claiming is supposed to be a warrant for that belief. So here one might say this is a clear example of an irrational belief, a belief held on evidence that isn't really evidence for this claim at all. Now, all sorts of cases of superstition might, of course, fall into this category. You know, believing that, I don't know, one can conjure ghosts, or stabbing a puppet will bring about that the person who is supposed to be represented by this puppet is going to die. Again, no causal connection between the figure of the puppet and the actual person. So again, one might argue here this is a clear case of irrational beliefs. Now, the question that arises is, are religious beliefs of this sort? One might wonder, are religious beliefs that fall into this category of superstition, where we simply believe things on the basis of dreams or where occult processes are going on, as in the case of supposed magic and so on? Or is religion really in a different category? Is something else going on in the case of religious belief? So that's the question I'm going to move on to next. Now, it seems that all monotheistic religions claim something like the following about God. They say God is a transcendent being who is beyond human comprehension, but who nevertheless is supposed to, in some sense, be able to interact with the world and with the human beings located within it. Now, that already, of course, throws up a serious problem. How is a being who is supposed to be located outside space and time, and in that sense outside of the empirical world, how is such a being supposed to interact with beings who are constrained by space and time, who exist within space and time? And furthermore, you know, how is one supposed to form a conception of the causal processes that are supposed to govern the interaction between a being who is, in some sense, outside of the empirical world and beings who are firmly located within that? So, if you like, the very definition of God already seems to throw up this kind of interaction problem. How does a radically transcendent God interact with human beings? Now, even more pressing, one might think, is the epistemological question, i.e. a question about knowing. I mean, how can we ever come to know anything about a being who, again, is supposed to be transcendent, who is located outside space and time? Ordinary empirical evidence that we tend to have for things, scientific evidence, testimony of our senses, etc. I mean, if by definition God is supposed to be a being who falls outside of this realm, who specifically is not just one more being located within the world, but is rather something that transcends the world, then how are we supposed to be able to find any evidence within this world for a being who, ex hypothesi, by definition, is not supposed to be locatable in it at all? Because by definition, he, under inverted commas, is supposed to be something radically different from us. And as more or less all religious believers affirm, unknowable and incomprehensible, lying beyond human understanding. So we seem to have a very serious epistemological problem simply by thinking about the concept of God. Now, some scientists have argued, I'm sure you've all heard of Richard Dawkins' comments about religion. I mean, Dawkins takes it that the sorts of reasons I've just given now are simply sufficient to show that natural science has so far managed to disprove the existence of God. And his assumption seems to simply go something like this: anything that lies beyond the capacity of natural science to find out about it is, by that token, something that cannot be real. So anything that is supposed to lie beyond the capabilities of investigation of natural science is thereby supposed to be something, according to Dawkins, that cannot possibly exist. So if, as I've argued earlier, God is a being who lies outside of the empirical world, then there couldn't possibly be any empirical evidence for the existence of this being. So one might wonder, does that mean that Dawkins is right? That, you know, there can't even in principle be any such such evidence, and therefore are we supposed to conclude that this is all just something that people have made up, something mythological, something irrational? Well, it seems that Dawkins is perhaps a bit too quick in making that assumption. Why? Well, because if it's true that as a matter of principle, as a matter of what the concept of God means, it's not possible to adduce any empirical evidence for God's existence, then in a way I can't claim that the fact that there is no empirical evidence available is a shortcoming. I mean, I can complain that empirical evidence is a shortcoming in cases where there could be empirical evidence for the existence of something. So, for example, if I wanted to find out whether there is actually a Loch Ness monster, for example, I could conduct a very painstaking search of the loch in question, and I could send divers in and scientists and all sorts of people who can try and find out whether there is actually such a monster located in this lake. But I can't conduct an empirical investigation of this sort in order to try and find out whether God exists, because in a way one might think trying to do that already shows that I've fallen into a kind of category mistake, because, you know, if God by definition is not some empirical object in the world but something that transcends the world, then obviously I can't go looking around, rooting around in the world in order to find such a being, because by definition, God is not supposed to be a being who is located in the world. So, in a way, I mean, Dawkins is right to say it seems that no empirical evidence is available, but that doesn't mean that he's right about making the further conclusion that therefore science has disproved that God exists. Rather, it seems science and religion here are on completely different planes. I mean, because religion wants to say something about a realm that lies radically beyond the empirical one, scientific investigation simply can't tell us anything about this, because science can only tell us about stuff located in the empirical world. So I can't then use that against the religious claims if it's obvious right from the start that religious claims don't actually concern the antics, if you like, of objects located in the empirical world. Now, of course, to say that is not to say that, therefore, if we want to side with religion, say, that therefore we're home and dry, because it still doesn't answer the question whether there is such a realm, and indeed whether we can know anything about whether such a realm might exist. So the mere fact that empirical evidence, a lack of empirical evidence per se, doesn't necessarily mean that science has disproved the existence of God, it still doesn't help us with, you know, if we actually want to find out whether there is such a realm, how we would go about doing it. For this reason, of course, philosophers and theologians have traditionally thought that the best way to try and go about establishing God's existence is not by arguing empirically, not by looking at the world in order to try and find out whether there is an object such as God located within it, but rather to focus on a priori arguments, i.e. arguments that use only deductive reasoning, arguments that don't rely on the actual state of the world, that don't appeal to anything empirical when trying to establish God's existence. And I mean, famously, these arguments tend to be the ontological argument. You might have come across Anselm's argument, trying to argue that the existence of God is a perfection, and given that God is a being who by definition has all perfections, God couldn't possibly lack a perfection, and if existence is a perfection, then he must have existence as well, because otherwise he'd lack a perfection, and therefore God must exist. Now, you probably all know as well that this argument, unfortunately, is fallacious, because existence is not a predicate. Existence isn't a quality. You can't say that existence is a perfection in the way that other qualities you might have are perfections. Rather, you have to exist in order to have perfections in the first place. So if something doesn't exist, it only has perfections in a purely notional sense. It doesn't actually have real perfection. So existence has to be presupposed if something is to have perfections. So therefore, the ontological argument unfortunately doesn't work. And for this reason, it's not, even though from time to time you do get metaphysicians who are trying to revive the ontological argument, that tends not to be an avenue that is explored all that much. Contrary, for example, to the design argument that has been given more prominence in recent times. And of course, All sorts of Christians in America have used design arguments to try and show that natural selection and chance and basically our whole scientific way of trying to explain how human beings came into existence isn't really sufficient to account for the existence of human beings. Now, why might anyone think that? Well, it seems, you know, people who are persuaded by the design argument tend to think the complexity of what evolution has to assume these days and the chance appealed to is just so improbable and so unlikely that therefore we have to assume that someone has designed these complexities because they're simply so complex and sophisticated, it's not reasonable to assume that they came about purely by chance. I mean, the patterns are just too complex for it to make sense to think that they haven't been designed by someone. Again, unfortunately, that isn't a particularly conclusive argument. Why not? Well, because there are all sorts of natural processes, all sorts of complex natural processes that exhibit very complex patterns. And nevertheless, it doesn't have to be the case at all that these patterns have been designed by anyone. A simple example might be the erosion that the wind makes in very soft stone near the sea, for example, might form really complex patterns in the stone, but nobody supposes that some supernatural agent is responsible for having brought these patterns into existence. So it seems you already have to believe that human beings have been designed in order to find it plausible to think that the sheer complexity of evolution and the scientific explanation and the appeal to chance and so on, you already have to be, in a way, persuaded that this isn't sufficient in order for the design argument to really be able to persuade you. So in a way, you almost already have to believe what the argument is supposed to prove in order to be persuaded by it, and that, of course, is a shortcoming in the argument. However, of course, whenever an argument is question-begging, i.e. whenever an argument assumes what is to be proved, you can usually level the same objection against the person holding the converse claim. So, you know, if a natural scientist wanted to argue, you know, it's just obvious that evolution demonstrates that, you know, we can't have been created by God, then that would be similarly question-begging because, you know, evolution can't show that. Rather, the whole scientific explanation already assumes that there cannot be such a thing as a supernatural process that has created us. That's simply not a hypothesis that science even takes seriously. I mean, no scientist is going to try and, you know, account for possible supernatural phenomena. Rather, it's agreed right from the beginning that, you know, everything has a natural explanation. So in that sense, again, there seems to be a standoff between religion on the one hand and science on the other. Neither can prove that, you know, God exists or doesn't exist, it seems. In recent times, a fairly famous Oxford theologian called Richard Swinburne has tried to revive again a version of the cosmological argument, which is basically very similar to the design argument. It basically argues that we need to assume a first cause who created the universe, and that first cause has to be God, because otherwise the chain of causes never stops. It only stops in some sort of absolute causa sui, a cause unto itself, which is God. And Swinburne argues that even according to the scientific criteria, I mean, even if you accept that the scientific criteria are the only criteria there could possibly be, even if you do that, he thinks, you can still show that it is far more likely that we were created by God than that we were created simply by a concatenation of chance events. Now, again, one might say a valiant attempt on Swinburne's part, but the question that obviously arises here is how on earth is one supposed to assign probability values to supernatural events. I mean, you know, the whole probability theory is based on observing ordinary empirical events in the ordinary human world. What criteria could we possibly have in the case of supernatural events? I mean, when can we say, you know, at this point it's probable that a supernatural agent caused the existence of the universe rather than, say, you know, natural scientific causes? It seems we don't really know quite what to say there. So Swinburne seems to be taking a lot for granted when he claims that it's simply more probable that God created us than that it all came about purely by chance. Okay, so where exactly does this leave us? I mean, it seems that all arguments for the existence of God must remain inconclusive. Does that then show that basically religious belief is irrational and we should have nothing to do with it? Well, perhaps not. The Danish philosopher Søren Kierkegaard, for example, whose birthday incidentally it is today, argued that we don't have to accept the assumption that so far I've been tacitly making, namely that it has to be the case that in order for a belief to be rational, we must first be able to demonstrate the existence of the thing that we believe in. So we might take the view that it's simply not necessary, and indeed in most cases, not just in the religious case, but in most cases not possible to demonstrate something's existence prior to forming a belief in it. Kierkegaard, for example, gives the example of trying to demonstrate your own existence. It's very difficult to try and find a way to demonstrate conclusively that you exist right now. It's not to say you don't, but try offering a demonstration for the fact that you exist. It seems very difficult to imagine, either empirically or simply on a priori grounds, how you would try and go about doing that, but we can talk about that in the discussion if you like. Similarly, it's also quite difficult, and one of the most vexed philosophical questions perhaps, to try and demonstrate that the external world exists, i.e. that, you know, tables, chairs and the whole universe exist and are not, say, just a figment of your own imagination. Again, I'm not trying to argue for the view that we shouldn't believe this or that this is really doubtful, only that it seems very difficult to try and offer a theoretical demonstration of the existence of the external world. And yet, of course, we all take this for granted, and indeed natural science takes this for granted. I mean, no experiment, nothing could get off the ground if you actually thought it really was doubtful that, you know, there are now external objects around us and you're sitting on them and so on. So, you know, we take all sorts of things for granted, one might say, without being able to offer a theoretical demonstration. Does that mean that really all of our ordinary beliefs are irrational? I think we would have to say not. So perhaps if we are willing to grant this in the non-religious case, we ought to be similarly courteous to religious belief and say, well, okay, it's perhaps not irrational to believe in God's existence, even if you cannot offer a demonstration that God actually exists. Now, against that, one might perhaps say, well, that's all very well, but is it not a further stretch to think that God exists merely on the grounds that I don't have to offer a demonstration for his existence? Because you might say, in the case of your own existence or in the case of the existence of the external world, even if we can't offer a demonstration, we are nevertheless immediately aware of, you know, the things around us and of ourselves and so on. So, you know, we actually interact with the external world. We interact with other people. We interact in some sense with ourselves. But is that the case with God? In what sense do we interact with God in the way that we interact with external objects and other people? Now, Kierkegaard would say, obviously, we do not interact with God in the way that we interact with other human beings. And indeed, he thinks as a religious believer one has to be incredibly careful about not falling into superstition. So Kierkegaard would probably accept everything I've said about the inconclusiveness of demonstrating God's existence. And he thinks it's actually crucial for religious believers to realise that you can't demonstrate the existence of God. However, he doesn't think that it follows from that you can't become aware of God in a different sense. He thinks what we have to do is to get away from sort of going outside of ourselves, looking at the world, and rather to concentrate on ourselves, to, as it were, look into our own hearts and what we find there, and that this would be the starting point to trying to find God. So Kierkegaard's idea is that we first have to become people capable of becoming aware of God. It's not something that you can just achieve, simply like that, without any reflection, without any training, etc. In the same way, that you can't become aware of mathematical patterns or musical patterns if you've not been taught any maths or you've not been taught any music. So Kierkegaard would say, similarly, we have to become beings who become aware of their own sins, who become aware of the need for redemption and so on, and that, once you become sensitized to these issues, then you might find a way of becoming in some sense aware of God. Now obviously that's a very condensed version of very complex things that Kierkegaard believes, but that would be an alternative to thinking it simply follows from the fact that we can't demonstrate God's existence, that therefore religious belief is irrational. Now, Kierkegaard doesn't argue that religious belief is rational. Rather, he thinks it's neither rational nor irrational. It's non-rational. Religious belief doesn't fall into either of these two categories. So he wouldn't say that someone who doesn't believe, somehow that there is anything epistemologically wrong with them, or indeed that it's a virtue, either an intellectual virtue, either to believe or not to believe. It's rather a personal question for him that everyone has to solve for themselves. What he does think is crucial, though, is honesty and not to delude oneself into thinking that, perhaps more evidence is available than there actually is, because he thinks if you do that, the way is paved to going down the road of fanaticism, which he was very much opposed to, even though often rashly, I think, Kierkegaard is labelled an irrationalist because of some of the things he says, but I think that's not the right line to take. But I'll leave it there, and very interested to hear what you think. Thank you. Okay.